This morning, we had another chance for reflection on the Dhamma. And you've seen during this past week, I had a chance to reflect on the ordinary and the mundane and all the worldly Dhammas of greed, hatred, and delusion, as well as reflect on the grand kind of visions that have been presented to the mind through the talks. And so this is important for you to consider, how to use the conditions we find ourselves with. Like yesterday, I talked on devotional practice and didn't get really very far into it. But the practice of metta as a way of learning to be mindful of the unpleasant, that which we find ugly and repulsive, that we experience through the mind, the senses. Another practice that is very much a part of the Theravadan tradition is what we call the sharing of merit. And this is greatly misunderstood by Western people, because the word merit itself somehow is not a very inspiring word. When you think of Girl Guides and Boy Scouts and the Brownies. But in Thailand or in Buddhist countries, merit is something that is greatly sought after and considered something quite worth pursuing, is to do good actions for gaining merit. Or for what we mean by this is by doing that which is good in the world, not for one thing, because if you've contemplated karma, you see that to do good you receive good, do bad you receive bad, but also for the welfare of all sentient beings. So in the act of sharing of merit, it's a skillful means which Buddhists use in order to let go of the idea of one gaining through meritorious action. In other words, one does a good action, and any merit or grace or goodness or good result or reward or happiness or joy or anything positive that one receives from this good action is to be shared and given back for the welfare of all sentient beings. Now this conceptual way of talking is a way of letting go of the idea of accumulating merit for oneself in a selfish way. The attitude of doing good for the welfare of others rather than for personal gain. Because the tendency, even in Thailand, is sometimes to think of that you yourself are accumulating great storehouses of merit by doing this. And by even sharing the merit with other beings, you're somehow gaining more merit by sharing. Now this is an act of devotion, which becomes quite significant in your life when you realize that you personally, you as an individual, your body and your mind has its profound effect on the universe. Where we tend to think of ourselves and think, what I do, it doesn't matter, I can do what I want, it's none of your business, if I do evil things, it's my business, not your business, if I'm not hurting you, why should you care? This tendency in the West to be very strongly identified to a sense of being a unique and individual that has no connection with anything else and somehow is outside the whole, And so what I do is my own business, not yours. And this has reached in the West, I think, its peak of selfish development in the recent years, to where our identities are so limited to this body and our desires that we're sometimes very, very insensitive and irresponsible to the people we're living with and the society that we're in and to the world. Because you think, none of your business, and if we think of our parents, you think our mothers, fathers say, that's not a very nice thing to do if you've done something very insensitive and cruel to your mother and father. And you say, shut up, it's none of your business. It's my life. I can do what I want, I'm over 21. How dare you interfere with my life? Trying to possess, hold on, keep the strings, and so forth. And we think, it's my life and I can do what I want with it. Whereas, say, in a previous time in the West, or as many Asian countries now, the tendency to identification tends to be broader rather than so specifically directed towards one's own body. Like in Thailand, Thai people tend to identify more with a family unit than with their stronger identity and sense of being a person is very much a part of a family, where I can see in my own life, I'm speaking from my own experience, is that one's identity with a family is very little nowadays, at least in my life. I don't feel any great strong identity with my parents, or with a class, or with even a nation. These things are very weak in my mind. They're not very strong. And therefore the identification tends to be very strong with the individual self, with me, with this body and the abilities and inabilities, my strengths and weaknesses, which tend to cause an increasing amount of anguish and despair as you grow older. You feel so isolated and alone, and so unable to communicate or understand or have communion with another being, because your conditioning is one of which you tend to cut off and separate and live in your own world, which doesn't include anyone else, really. So in the sharing of merit, we begin to understand that what we do, how we live, has its profound effect on the universe we live in. Now this was quite an awakening for myself, because before I had very much of this sense of none of your business, I can do what I want. And then through, meditation and beginning to understand what the universe really is, I began to see that I had to be responsible for how I live, because not being a mean and nasty and evil person by nature, I never have really wanted to be responsible for causing unnecessary misery and suffering to other beings. And I could see that if I lived foolishly and stupidly and selfishly, that this has its effect on the universe, on the people I live with, on the society I'm in, and on the country, and on the world. So all sentient beings suffer because of my stupidity and selfishness. Now I reflect on this in the monastery. We reflect on this every morning, and the attitude of sharing the merit of our lives, living our lives during the day in a way that is trying to be as skillful and as sensitive as possible, our actions to be done not for, our own desire to be enlightened, but for the welfare and concern for all sentient beings. When people ask me, what are you doing for the third world? Say, I share my merit with all beings in the third world, second, first. Making no preferences. And when we think, if we reflect that if we live foolishly and stupidly, we're adding that much more momentum and power to all that is heedless and stupid and foolish in the world. And there's already so much of that. Anyway, we don't need to feel obligated to add to that. What is, there seems to be a lack, particularly now, is concentrated effort in doing good and living mindfully. So, and then the merit, any merit to be shared, to do this not for one's own sake, but for the welfare of all sentient beings. Then in the practice of sharing of merit, we reflect on, it's like a Buddhist way of praying for somebody, like somebody's ill. Christians will come and they'll say, my wife has cancer and she's not expected to live much longer. Do you Buddhists pray? And I say, oh yes, we do. And she said, well, will you pray for my wife? And so we say in our morning chanting in there, the merit of our lives, any grace or goodness that we might gain is to be shared. Or good actions done, particularly for, say, and the merit of that good action to be shared with that particular person who's ill. So in Buddhist countries, like, people will come and they'll say, they'll give a dana, they'll give food to the monks, and they'll say, can this merit be shared with so-and-so who's ill, or with parents who have departed, or whoever one wants to share it with. So you particularly, say, specify the name of that person, and then add, and all sentient beings. So that even though your this particular, say, food might be offered for the welfare of and growth and enlightenment of one's mother, it's not only for one's mother, but for all sentient beings. So this is the Buddhist way of developing the devotional side of religious practice. It's an expanding of the heart in this way to include all, without preference, without distinction, from the finest, say, to the monk, say, to the upachaya, the preceptor that ordained us, to all the teachers who have taught us, to parents and husband, wife, brothers, sisters, good friends, the king and queen, the rulers of the country. We share our merit every day at Chithurst with the Prime Minister, the members of Parliament. with all, say, all the animal realms, all the animal world, and all those in various stages of anguish and despair, such as criminals and people locked away in mental institutions, all those who are sick and weak, or drug addicts and so forth, down to the most malevolent and brutal beings that exist in the world, the merit offered equally to all sentient beings. In this way, you begin to include within your heart, in a very conscious way, all possibilities of existence, of sentient beings that could possibly exist, from the highest, like the deva, kind of ethereal, refined beings to the coarsest and most evil, and all gradations in between. Now this act of devotion is a way of developing the heart. You say it's not to be a rational, sensible kind of thing in which you have to be guaranteed that you give so much food, you'll get so much of a reward. Or to see vivid evidence that your meritorious life has really had its profound effect on the third world, or that offering merit every day for criminals in prisons and drug addicts is really solving their problems. This is not a rational kind of thing where you're weighing on a scale the amount of goodness you're doing by the effects that you can see with the eye or hear with the ear. It's an act of faith. And so this devotion is faith. And faith is action in the world. It's how we live and relate within the human form to the other human or sentient beings that surround us and that we are part of. And this is what we mean by devotion. Now, we find within Buddhism itself and in Britain a sense of not understanding the value of devotional practice because it's connected with kind of blind faith, you know, kind of smarmy, sweet sentiments that seem that only foolish people tend to reiterate. And if we consider ourselves one who doesn't fall for all those silly kind of sentimental things, we tend to feel an aversion arising in our mind toward devotional practices, like bowing or lighting of candles and incense, chanting, offering of merit, spreading metta, and all this kind of thing we can all lump together and say superstition or foolishness. I want the pure teaching of the Dhamma, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and give me a practical kind of meditation practice that makes sense and that I can accept, and then I'll do it. But I don't want any of that other stuff. Now, in practice of meditation, you say that like the compassion and joy. Now, these are developed in one's life as we tend to, say, learn to give out rather than to take. So much of the time, you hear people say, "What did you get out of that meditation retreat?" When you heard his talk, did you get anything from it? You went to this Buddhist center somewhere. What did you get out of it? Now, this sense of what are we getting from all this? What this Buddhist society summer school? What are we getting out of it? Okay, this attitude is the attitude of one who still does not understand karma or rebirth, and who still goes at things with the idea of getting something. And so when we change that to, say, giving rather than taking, like when we come here to the Buddhist Society Summer School, what are we giving to it? Can we give anything? How can we help it? How can we give to it? Rather than, what am I getting out of it? You see, now this attitude of giving takes a lot of humility and patience. And yet this very attitude is the attitude which is the path to enlightenment. What can I give? How can I help? And if we can just give ourselves to the summer school, to be one who's content with with the things as they are, rather than complaining about this or that. Reflecting on what's being said without demanding that things be said that we agree with, but being able to accept even that those things that baffle us or that we don't agree with a patient patience and humility. Being grateful for the things offered, for the talks given, rather than being critical and saying, oh, I didn't like that, no, I don't agree with that. That is attitude of feeling gratitude for people who have taken the time to come in and offer some kind of experience or knowledge or information or help that they have experienced or that they can give us. Then we accept with gratitude and say thank you very much. Whether we agree or not, whether it's been absolutely fantastic or very minimal, we don't care anymore. We're not concerned about the amounts or how much we get. Even if we get just a little bit, or even if nothing, be grateful for that, because then you're approaching more what was talked about last evening. So this, say, compassion and joy, karuna mudita, and upekha, we've already discussed metta. Metta is, upekha is the equanimity. And this is, say, being able to remain balanced in oneself, no matter what life presents to us. In other words, if we're lacking in upekha in our lives, we tend to be carried away all the time by the qualities we're experiencing through the senses. If you have no upekha at all, somebody says to you, you're absolutely wonderful, you're divine, and you jump for joy, hooray, you get very high. Now, that's a really wonderfully sensitive person. Then someone else comes along and says, you're so stupid and disgusting. And you become terribly depressed. You want to kill yourself or kill the person. And this is a genuine lack of equanimity. In other words, what other people say seems to overwhelm you. If it's positive and good, you're very happy. If it's insulting and unpleasant, you'll become depressed. Same applies to, say, good fortune and bad fortune. You inherit £1 million. You jump for joy. And you lose £1 million and you start thinking of ways of killing yourself. No upekha, no equanimity. You succeed or you fail. You become a great worldly success, acclaimed, the greatest human being since somebody. And you feel joyful and happy and wonderful, and then you're humiliated and despised by the world and you feel depressed. No upekha, no equanimity. So in developing equanimity, it's in seeing the equal value of both praise and blame, success and failure, good fortune and bad fortune. These are happiness and suffering. By seeing that both praise and blame, they come and they go, they change. One feels good, one doesn't. But you begin to see that it's not self. You begin to say, examine the reactions you have, the impulses you have in your own mind. Like in your lives, your daily lives, if you start looking at your own mind, rather than trying to, say, transform yourself into the ideal, or feeling that you more or less have been given a bad kind of deal in life, and you have to more or less just live in a miserable state of what you think you are, you begin to penetrate the very feelings of happiness and suffering, success and failure, good fortune and bad fortune, praise and blame. And you see that even depression, even though it has an eternal appearance of eternality, is only a moment in time. Same with happiness. In the meditation, wisdom arises through this kind of investigation, which is not a judgmental investigation, such as analyzing the conditions by saying one kind of happiness is better than another, or you're not trying to figure yourself out according to theories that you have about what you should be or shouldn't be, but you just observe, be content with the moment as it is, meaning whatever it is, you're aware of it as it is, and see how long it lasts. Be one who has courage to investigate things. Even the most unpleasant and painful situations are filled with every possibility for enlightenment if you make the effort to do so. So in wisdom, you see, wisdom is where there is no thing. And in compassion, we have compassion for everything. So in these two seemingly opposed things, where everything and nothing, we find our balance, because we're not making preferences anymore. We're not seeking annihilation or an idea of emptiness as a place that we should be identified with, nor are we seeking our identity among all the myriad manifestations that we experience through the mind. But we begin to be at peace with the arising and passing of conditions and with the emptiness. In other words, there's no attachment to either extreme. No effort to identify with greed, hatred, and delusion, nor with no greed, hatred, and delusion. So in this practice of meditation, the Buddha was, I think people, it's very hard for Western people to realize that the Buddha was not in any way philosophizing about the nature of existence, or theorizing, or creating any doctrines about the nature of things, but pointing a way only that is very practical. It's not a denial nor an affirmation, but a pointer. And so therefore, when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Three Characteristics of Existence, so forth, we're not saying to be a Buddhist you have to believe in anatta, or you have to believe in karma and rebirth, or you have to believe in the Buddha. It's not a matter of belief at all. It's not saying to believe or disbelieve, but to find out through your own direct experience of it. In, say, in the Theravada tradition, it's a very simple kind of Buddhist teaching. Nothing much is taught other than the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And then people tend to criticize Theravadins because they have these ideas about there's something more than that. And so, so that you start thinking, well, you know, you want something like one would like to read Shakespeare, rather than start learning the ABCs. See, if you think there's Hamlet and Macbeth, that's much more interesting than A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But you can't very well start out, unless you have incredible bar meters from previous lives, reading Hamlet. We have to start out with a simple A, B, C, D. Now, once you learn the basic skills, what you do with them is up to you, isn't it? Once you learn how to read, and this is a book, I am a man, you can find out, you can begin to read more complicated literature than that. But that's up to you, how far you want to go, what you want to do with it. There, let's say, in teaching meditation, it's just a mere way of teaching basic skills, developing some skill in a way of seeing things clearly. And then the rest becomes quite clear. And you talk about shunyata or things of that nature. That becomes quite obviously real if you already have penetrated the fact that the things that we think, feel, see, experience through the senses are not self, are just the impermanent conditions arising and passing. All that begins ends, all that arises passes away. And as I've said once before, in the very first sutta, the Dhammajaka Sutta, that the Buddha gave in the deer park in Benares to the five disciples was just this basic exposition of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Then the end of it, the disciple Kondanya understands. And the Buddha praises him. He says, oh, Kondanya, understand. He knows, Anya Kondanya. And what does Kondanya understand? That all that arises passes away. So this is why in our practice, rather than trying to have the God-like vision from the heavenly realms, the celestial view, and understand everything in all its complexity, we content ourselves with understanding the mundane, the ordinary, and penetrating the ordinary, just like the breath, the inhalation, the exhalation, just walking, sitting, standing, lying down, just the most ordinary conditions of our daily lives. There's the Dhamma, the profound Dhamma in all these actions that we experience in our lives. To be enlightened with. If you're trying to seek to understand on the grand view, it'd be terribly because that's not the lesson we're to. That's not our. That's not what we need to do in this lifetime as human beings. Because we can only understand the grand through understanding the most humble, the most ordinary. So that's why meditation is always here and now, with whatever is, as it is, no matter what its quality might be, high or low, good or bad. And the act of giving out, rather than of getting. How much can we give? Let's make our lives one of giving, rather than of taking. Because in this outward giving, in that very motion of going out like this, is an act of opening. This, like your body is opening up, isn't it? Where grasping or taking is closing off, shutting ourselves off. The act of giving, just like opening the palm, giving out, physically it's even an opening out to others.
Bhaktan, could you have Would it be possible to say a little more about the cultivation of upekkha?
Like the in the Theravada school, there are 10 paramitas. The last two listed are metta and upekkha. And those are also the first and the last of the Brahma Viharas, you know, if you've noticed. The two, karuna and mudita, are not considered paramitas. Because these paramitas are perfections that one develops. And therefore, karuna, mudita tend to arise quite spontaneously when there is mindfulness, when the other paramitas have been established in one's life. Now, upekkha people tend to translate that as kind of indifference or equanimity. Sometimes they'll use the word indifference, which means not being concerned with anything. So many people feel upekkha is just kind of shutting oneself off and saying, and as you see some maniac comes into this room and starts slashing away at everybody, I just say, impermanent condition, not so. I would become kind of monster myself, wouldn't I? Not being totally indifferent to what's going on. But the upekkha is that in ourselves, say, a way of not being overwhelmed by the qualities of success or failure, good fortune or bad fortune, happiness or suffering, praise or blame that we experience. Now that doesn't mean we're indifferent in the sense of insensitive to praise and blame. You're not just, say, repressing any kind of feeling that arises and saying, oh, I shouldn't feel happy if I'm praised and I shouldn't feel depressed if I'm criticized. It's not that, because then one tends to repress and ignore or look away from. But upekkha means to maintain a cool, calm centeredness toward praise and blame, so that we can be aware of the habits we already have. Like, it's natural, and I personally, from speaking from my own knowledge of my own character, is that when somebody says, you're absolutely wonderful, I like that. And when somebody says, you're rotten and disgusting, I don't like to hear that either. Now, it's not that I should like to hear the true facts of existence, that I'm rotten and disgusting, and that I should despise hearing the untrue fact that I'm absolutely wonderful. It's not playing games with your mind at all. But it's awareness of the feelings of liking and disliking that arise, and knowing them just as they are, knowing feeling is feeling. And in that, you become equanimous with it. You can accept praise and listen to blame without repression or indulgence. So, because sometimes in praise there's a lot of truth. Sometimes we are absolutely wonderful, all of us. And at other times we're absolutely rotten. And sometimes people are just being nasty. They're just saying you're absolutely rotten because they're angry with you and they want to hurt you. And sometimes people are being obsequious, trying to get something from us by saying you're absolutely wonderful. But we can listen, you know, and in that awareness, is the ability to respond appropriately, because we've not been, we're not blaming others, we're not reacting to what's being said in a foolish and heedless way. So in Ajahn Chah, he was always, his one of his great points of stressing in teaching when he was in England last year was, see all conditions of equal value, success or failure. Now, say we all like to feel that what we're doing is successful. It was a successful summer school. Oh, yeah. And then somebody says, it was a failure. It was really the worst summer school I've ever seen. And we feel, oh, I don't think I'll even go next year. You see, we're reacting. But when we hear, you know, what it was a really successful summer school, we can accept that without trying to deny it. Because we, you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's a matter of opinion. Or if it is the most miserable one that one's ever been to, that's a matter of opinion, but one can accept and learn from both success and failure, from good fortune and bad fortune, good health and bad health, from whatever conditions we experience in our lives. We see they all take us to the same place, into the deathless. You see, so if there's a, in the suttas they say, what is the essence of all conditions? The Buddha said, deliverance is their essence. So all conditions, no matter what those conditions might be, good or bad, if you're aware of them, take you, deliver you from delusion. And where do all conditions merge? Into the deathless. So, when we are patient and humble and equanimous, then we can allow everything to teach us and merge into the deathless. Does that answer your question?